Countrywide on ABC Radio.
I'm absolutely calling on the Deputy Prime Minister to pay attention to his own report.
Growers work from sun up to sun down, sir.
Countrywide.
We need to speak to these growers at 1 o'clock in the morning.
And to actually act on behalf of the farmers.
They're going to get it from the Yanks or the French or whoever. Let's get our foot in the door and let's be the first.
Countrywide. The politics of food and farming on ABC Radio.
Hello there, I'm Isabella Pittaway. Coming up on the show today, with Easter almost upon us, you may be enjoying some seafood soon. But do you know where the seafood on your plate has come from? A new study has asked just that, and you might be surprised by its results. Plus bushfires, drought, birds and even bats, it's been a tough vintage for winemakers in eastern Victoria.
We're looking at the Pinot Grigio or Pinot Gris right now, and I was meant to be picking that the Sunday that everything burnt down, so lost the whole year's production in that one because the smoke taint just ruins them. Wines end up smelling like an ashtray.
But first, it's something often talked about and the question's been raised again. Should children be banned from riding quad bikes? Last weekend, there were three accidents involving quad bikes, including two fatalities. A seven-year-old boy was killed while riding a quad bike in Western Australia's southwest, while a nine-year-old Tasmanian boy died at a family member's rural property. A child was also taken to hospital after falling off a quad bike at Laceby in northern Victoria. Anthony Pansia spoke to Associate Professor at the Australian Centre for Agricultural Health and Safety, Tony Lower, who says it's time to ban children riding quad bikes of any size.
The key thing is that, to sum it up really, is that unfortunately quad bikes and kids are a fatal mix. We know that around 15% of all the deaths involving quad bikes involve children, and that includes both the full-size bikes and the smaller bikes as well. Because unfortunately there's not much margin for error when using these vehicles, and in cases particularly where the vehicles roll over, people are unable to actually extricate themselves from underneath the vehicle.
This is a traumatic event for two families in two different parts of Australia. Is it time to perhaps rethink a complete ban for having children on these bikes?
Well, certainly we'd actually support a complete ban on children using quad bikes of any size. That includes the smaller versions as well, because unfortunately they can be up to 125 kilograms themselves, and obviously if they do roll over, those problems that we've just discussed do come into play. So we'd be very keen to actually see all products, particularly the smaller ones, but also making sure that parents don't allow children to use the larger bikes, because simply kids don't have the physical or the cognitive capacity to actually use them safely. And by the same token, we're really keen on supporting agriculture and making sure that children enjoy agriculture and actually get to learn the skills that are required. So what we really recommend is that parents, if they want their children to use a vehicle, is to put them on a suitably sized two-wheeler, ensure they've got the correct protective gear on, and ensure that they're supervised, particularly in the early stages of learning. Because we do know from the fatality data that there's far less risk of fatalities from two-wheel motorbikes.
I mean, obviously these tragedies aren't restricted to children. In general, then, what else can be done to, you know, boost safety on these things?
I think, unfortunately, the prevalence of deaths involving quad bikes has meant that they've become quite notorious in terms of their use. And there has been already a very big push to other types of safer vehicles like side-by-side vehicles or even farm utes that can be used in certain circumstances as well. Now, that will obviously vary depending on the agricultural business that you're running about what can and can't be used. However, we'd really strongly recommend that people remove quad bikes from their fleet, and that's certainly been done with many businesses across Australia. And if that's not possible and people still want to use a quad bike, then there's some really key things that need to be done. One is to ensure that you fit a crash protection device to the vehicle, because we do know that they will reduce the prevalence of crash and asphyxiation injuries, which are very common within the agricultural sector in particular, and also ensure that a helmet's worn and that appropriate safety standards and areas where you actually may ride the vehicles and how you ride those vehicles on the property are insured.
This is obviously a very, very tragic event, as is any fatality involving an a quad bike. Are there any sort of similarities or constant themes in these accidents?
There's a large number of similarities across the incidents. Farming incidents tend to involve rollovers. Recreational incidents tend to involve people being ejected from the vehicles. But sadly, one of the things that we're really trying to address at the moment, and the ACCC have put forward a draft proposal to improve the stability of quad bikes, which would be a step in the right direction, and also to ensure that crash protection devices are fitted to all new quad bikes that actually come into operation within Australia. So those two items alone will actually have a significant impact on the safety of these vehicles and, unfortunately, the injury burden that they place on Australian farmers and the Australian community.
Associate Professor at the Australian Centre for Agricultural Health and Safety, Tony Lower, ending that report by the ABC's Anthony Pansia. Well, the devastating floods that hit northwest Queensland in February caused significant economic damage for communities from Normanton to Richmond and Hughenden to Cloncurry. But as the clean-up process begins, the scale of the disaster is being tallied by government and industry bodies. And the figures of cattle deaths and infrastructure losses are sobering statistics. Tom Major spoke to General Manager of Projects for AgForce, Andrew Freeman, who says the total cost of the floods will reach the billions of dollars.
So the rainfall event sort of basically started on the Australia Day long weekend and went for about the next 10 days. So on around the 12th of February, we started looking for some information from landholders in the affected areas about what their stock losses were and also some of the, you know, what their expected infrastructure losses were going to be. And they were basically put into to a model, and with some mapping and GIS capacity, we produced a bit of a quite an accurate estimation of like the effects and the area affected across the Gulf and Mitchell Grass Downs country. I'll just start with the physical infrastructure. So you know, you're looking at over 5,000 kilometres of fences lost in the Gulf Plains, 4,500 on the Mitchell Grass Downs, and a total of nearly 10,000 across both those areas. In terms of roads, there was a pretty significant impact if you think of the road network that actually operates on property. And this is outside of civil infrastructure, so your highways. It was over 15,500 kilometres. In terms of water pipeline, over 1,000 kilometres of water pipeline lost, and estimation of about 778 water points. So if we also look at livestock losses, we estimated a total loss of around 664,000 head of stock. So that was across the total area. The biggest effect was in the Gulf Plains area, where you had an estimated cattle loss of 197,000. In Carpentaria was quite high as well, 171,000 head there. Croydon was probably the other end of the spectrum, and with less than around 722 head. Richmond Downs and the Winton Downs area, 65,000 and 64,000 head. So you know, when you extrapolate those figures across the area, the losses were quite significant, and they're also made worse by the wind chill factor. It also impacted heavily on livestock losses across a wide area.
So we've got some shires there very heavily affected, particularly the Carpentaria and McKinlay shires by the looks of things, and they would be certainly the areas that would struggle to get back on their feet the worst, you'd say, at this time?
I think the thing with it was sort of the nature and the spread of the floodwaters. While they were relatively shallow between that, you know, in the Flinders, Richmond and McKinlay shires across the Cloncurry, there's certainly a huge tongue of water that went out through Carpentaria, very deep, and you know, certainly we expect fairly fast flowing, and that's been, I guess, typical of what we've seen in those areas previously when we've had flood events of this nature.
Very difficult to tally the total cost to northwest Queensland from these floods, but in terms of the raw statistics, what is the financial loss in terms of livestock?
The financial loss in terms of livestock, I suppose if you use a fairly, you know, just a back of an envelope figure really of, say, $1,000 a head, you're probably looking up around $800 million. That's for stock losses alone. Plus, then when you add in the on-farm infrastructure plus civil infrastructure, like the damage that was done to railway lines and, you know, the road network, it'd have to be, you know, pushing up towards at least $2 billion. So in Northwest, it's certainly been a significant economic event that's going to take a long time to recover from.
That was General Manager of Projects for Ag Force Andrew Freeman speaking to Tom Major. $800 million in livestock deaths alone is a terrible figure, and there's a huge task ahead for all those involved in the recovery. You're listening to Countrywide. My name's Isabella Pittaway. Now, do you know where the seafood on your plate has come from this Easter? A new study by the Australian Barramundi Farmers Association and University of Sunshine Coast Food Research Group has asked just that, and you might be surprised by its results. The Barramundi Farmers Association Executive Officer Joanne Rusco says understanding consumer trends is particularly important during Easter, which is one of the busiest times of the year for Aussie fishers.
Well, we wanted to make sure that we had a customer focus, and we were looking to better understand the relationship that Australians had with the barramundi they buy and eat, because our farmers want to be certain that our Australian barramundi is meeting expectations, and that's expectations from the consumer, the wholesaler, the retailer and the chef, and we wanted to meet those expectations every time.
And looking at this research, I mean, what were some of the trends that you identified?
Well, it was quite interesting, actually. Seafood consumption's increasing overall, and particularly in the younger populations of people 24 years and older, 24 to 35 years age. And there is an emerging trend, particularly in that younger age bracket, to prefer seafood over other proteins. What that means, they're moving towards a more pescatarian diet. And we found that Australians, they love their national fish. Barramundi was actually nominated by over 35% of consumers as one of their top three preferred species of fish, excluding kinfish.
Did some of those results surprise you at all?
No, it doesn't surprise me, actually. But, the research certainly confirmed that consumers, they value the barramundi's freshness, its flavour, its quality, its texture and its taste. But what did surprise us was that we also found out that 41% of Australians don't know whether their seafood is local or imported. And that's a concern for buyers and for Australian barramundi producers.
And what would the association like to get from this research to change that trend?
Well, we need to make sure that people's perceptions match the reality. I mean, the name barramundi comes from an Aboriginal name, and we think of it as our national fish. And most people assume it's Australian, but the reality is that 60% of the barramundi consumed in Australia is imported from Asia. So this research, it gives us a better understanding of what our customers value, and we can do our bit to address the gap in consumer information about where their fish comes from. And our barramundi is grown by real Aussie farmers, and no one else in the world produces the barramundi with the same quality and deliciousness and with such regard for environmental sustainability. So what we'll be doing is we'll continue to call for transparency in the hospitality industry, and we'll continue to call for government regulation to include on menus where seafood is from.
That is something that we've seen the Territory do. They've changed their labelling laws in restaurants, so fish has to be identified as local or imported. Is that something you'd like to see across the board in Australia?
Absolutely. Australians have a right to know where their seafood is from and make an educated choice on whether they purchase Australian or imported seafood. And it doesn't matter whether you're buying it from the supermarket or whether you're buying it from a restaurant.
Obviously, from a policy perspective, that's something that you don't have all that much control over, but I guess is that something you'll be lobbying for as an industry?
Yeah, that's right. We'll continue to work on that. But, we'll also be working hard to make our product more visible and readily available. And we need to step outside our farms a little bit more and be more involved in the supply chain. And so that's a really important message for us. We need to get to know our wholesalers and our buyers. And we'll certainly be doing that.
And it does seem to be a trend across, agriculture as a whole, as well as aquaculture and fishing industries, just telling the story better of the product.
That's right. It's a great story too. I mean, these are Australian farmers, and they're amazingly dedicated to producing a wonderful fish. They're environmentally sustainable, and there's no doubt that our farmers are able to meet that gap between the imported and the domestic product. Your listeners can do their bit too, and we encourage them to consider where your fish is from, and if it's important to you, then support local farmers and ask for Aussie barra or Aussie seafood this Easter.
The report's just being released before Easter. I suppose you're asking consumers to be a bit more mindful this Easter when they're picking up their seafood.
Absolutely. So Easter is only after Christmas. It's the second biggest time for eating seafood. It's really important to Australians. And so, you know, ask for it. Visit restaurants you know that serve Australian sustainable barramundi. Ask for Aussie barra at retailers. And if you're cooking at home over the break, you know, Australian barramundi is one of the easiest to cook. It's versatile and it's delicious.
And Joe, how are you planning to plate up your barra this Easter?
I'll definitely be planning it up and I'll be doing it on the barbecue.
Can't go past some barbecued barra.
Absolutely. Crispy skin, a little bit of salad and a nice crisp white wine.
Australian Barramundi Farmers Association Executive Officer Joanne Rusko speaking there with Courtney Fowler.
You're listening to Countrywide across Australia and around the world on ABC Radio.
Let's stay with seafood because it's quality over quantity for two southern Tasmanian fishermen. The pair use recreational-style rod and line to target high-quality sashimi-grade tuna. But catching these fish is only half the battle. They need extra special care to fetch top dollar. Hugh Hogan has the story.
126, Thomas.
This wharf at the edge of the city has come to life as fresh southern bluefin tuna is unloaded, graded, and sent off to restaurants in Hobart, Sydney and Melbourne as quickly as possible.
I think we got about 800 kilo this trip. It was pretty slow the first day, but we made up for it on the second day.
Ash Garland is one of the fishermen who caught all of this bluefin tuna, just like they did in the old days, by rod and reel. They do this to target only top-quality sashimi-grade fish.
Yeah, so we sort of just pick and choose. Anything under 20 kilo, we sort of throw back. So we probably threw back 40 or 50 fish this trip. We just want the higher quality because it just wastes the quota otherwise, and, you know, it's more sustainable for the fishery, leaving the smaller ones there. We just grade them as we're catching them as well, and you sort of look for, like, fatness through the tail. They sort of look cricket bat-like shape or a junk, like a football shape. You look for the fatter sort of ones. They're generally the better grades. They've got more fat in them.
These fishermen say they're the only commercial fishers in Australia catching tuna with a rod and reel where the fish are hand-selected for the weekly market requirements. Aidan Jackson is the other fisherman.
Yeah, so we're using skirted lures with a special Jobo hook that hasn't got really a barb, so when we catch our fish, we keep it nice and tight, so the fish we want to keep, we can keep them pretty easily, but the fish that we want to release, it's just a real quick flick on the side of the boat and it swims away.
It's hard work reeling it in by hand, but at $30 a kilo, some of these fish are worth $3,000 each. That's if they're treated correctly, and that's what these fishers work hard to do.
Within 3 minutes, I've got the fish cleaned, wrapped on, and then in on the ice in an ice slurry. Yeah, we're trying to do it as quick as possible. Every minute after we leave it, it goes up a degree inside, and so then it ends up starting to cook the flesh.
The operation has caught the attention of fishery scientist Dr. Sean Tracy.
We're very interested in this new fishery here off the bottom of Tasmania because it's a rod and line fishery, so they're basically catching the fish the same way that the recreational fishers would, but they are handling each fish like an absolute baby from hookup to unloading, as we're seeing here today. So they're making sure that they're brain spiking the fish, it's humane killing, it's icing the fish down, gill guts, making sure every fish is in its absolute best condition.
He says the fishery was poorly managed in the past.
So it was overfished in the late 70s and 80s. You know, it was one of those things that they just didn't know a lot about it at the time. There were a lot of countries that were accessing it. Japan and Australia were two of the big players because obviously the fish swim well outside Australia's EEZ. They basically inhabit the whole Southern Ocean, sort of from South Africa to New Zealand. But since that time, there's been cooperative management through the Commission for the Conservation of Southern Bluefin Tuna. And we've now seen a stock recovery. It did get very low to 5 to 6% of the virgin biomass. It's now up to 13%. And very recently, the status of Australian fish stocks has it moving from overfished to recovering, which is a good sign. But these kind of initiatives with this rod and line fishing, I think, are really different and unique way to use what is an amazing product.
Four fish you keep maybe 1 week, much better.
Oh, wow. So it actually improved.
Yeah. Two fresh, no good. Same like a beef.
Narito Ishisan supplies tuna to high-end restaurants in Sydney. He's teaching the fishermen how to grade the fish, and checking the rod and reel method isn't affecting quality.
When you're fishing, you have to fight with the tuna. If you fight long time, the tuna get burned themselves. So I just wanted to check the quality. So, but actually, tuna is quite good.
And what do you look for in the tuna?
For sashimi grade, top grade, good colour and oil contents, nice flavour. And then I want to teach the fishermen to grade it, how to grade it.
Fighting with tuna can release adrenaline into the muscles. Here's Aidan Jackson again.
Adrenaline looks like petrol inside. So that when the fish has gone real ballistic beside the boat. Yeah, so it's really shimmery. So that's not very good for us. It's like it just makes it a little bit of a worse taste for it.
You want to fight them for about 20 minutes and then the adrenaline soaks back into the meat and then the fish is prime quality then.
If they can keep supplying good quality sashimi, Norito will be able to sell it in Japan where it can fetch $50 a kilo. Either way, they say, there's plenty of demand in Australia for this new fishery.
Yeah, it's we've only been doing it for 4 weeks, so it's grown massively in the last 4 weeks. Pretty hard work, but yeah, it's good. It's going well.
Ash Garland finishing that story by Hugh Hogan. Well, what goes better with seafood than a glass of wine? And in some good news, Australia has had a win in a trade battle with Canada, with the country agreeing to end restrictions on the sale of Aussie wine in the province of British Columbia. Australia launched action against Canada in the World Trade Organization last year over concerns Australian wine had restricted access in that market. Australian Wine and Grapes Chief Executive Tony Battalin told Cassie Huff the World Trade Organization case will remain open, but Australia will also look at resolving the rest of the issues outside the official process.
Yeah, we've had some good progress there. So following some problems in the provinces of British Columbia, Ontario, Quebec and Nova Scotia, we initiated World Trade Organization action. So the panel for that World Trade Organization has been established, which means that essentially it's in a position to now go to court. However, the good thing is that this, due to the Trade Minister met with his counterpart in Canada and they have agreed, Canada have agreed to withdraw some of the measures they have in British Columbia, and so that we will drop that out of the World Trade Organization case now. So that aspect of the case has been fixed, which is a really good result.
Was that the bulk of the issue that you had?
It was the biggest issue in financial terms. So the others are smaller issues, but they're still measures that we would like to see resolved. So those progress will continue unless we can get to a negotiated settlement on them as well.
What's the next step then?
The panel will continue to do its job. So the Secretariat will meet to allocate resources to it. In the meantime, the Australian Foreign Affairs officials are preparing the legal case. I know the Trade Minister has been very actively working with his counterpart in Canada to try and get a settlement to this. So that appears like it will be difficult now because with the election being called. So we will run both processes in parallel. We will go forward with the WTO case, but if the Canadian government and our government can agree on a settlement, then we'll proceed down that route. So at the moment, it's all looking very promising.
Australia's wine industry has been one of the main agricultural industries that's been focused on as part of Brexit and the issues that could be seen in Australia's agricultural sector. Now that the EU and the UK have agreed to delay Brexit again until October, what does that mean for Australian wine?
Well, having a delay is not a positive move for anyone because everyone is looking for certainty within Brexit to actually understand what the rules of racing will be. We've managed to insulate our sector as much as possible so that we've got an Australian-UK wine agreement, which replicates the conditions we had under the European wine agreement, which is good. But there's still inevitably going to be problems and changes in certification requirements and the like coming into the UK market. So none of us welcome Brexit, but we are probably as insulated as possible. And like everyone, we just want to see this resolved and we know one way or the other what the rules are.
That's Australian Wine and Grapes Chief Executive Tony Battalin speaking there to Cassie Huff. Well, talk about a tough vintage. Bushfires, drought, birds and even bats, they're all issues that Eastern Victoria's winemakers have had to contend with. Last month, a bushfire in the Bunyip State Park destroyed the Jinx Creek Winery in West Gippsland and saw other wineries lose much of their crop to smoke taint. While in East Gippsland, winemakers already battling drought were rushing to pick their grapes to avoid smoke taint from other fires. For Jinx Creek winemaker Andrew Clark, it's a vintage he would rather forget.
We lost our business, our livelihood and our home as well.
Last month, on the Sunday Mr. Clark was due to start picking his grapes, a bushfire swept through his Tonnenbuck property, destroying his home, winery, cellar door, and burning up vineyards that had been planted in 1979.
That part of the vineyard really got hammered, and I'm going to pull it out. I think one of the things I'm realising is how ferocious this fire was. It really was incredibly intense. It did a lot of damage. A lot of houses around here burnt down, and indiscriminately as well, so as usual with bushfires.
Adding to Mr. Clark's pain is that the grapes on the vines that weren't burnt can't be used because of smoke taint.
We're looking at the Pinot Grigio or Pinot Gris right now, and I was meant to be picking that the Sunday that everything burnt down, so that's a month ago, so they're well and truly gone now. They're way too sweet, of course, but they were looking fantastic, and lost the whole year's production in that one because, as you said, the smoke taint just ruins them. Wines end up smelling like an ashtray, so it's not much point processing them.
Mr. Clark also lost wine from last year's vintage and estimates that alone would have cost around $500,000. Further east in Gippsland, winemakers were rushing to harvest their crop to avoid smoke taint from various fires in the region. Glenmaggie Wines put a call out on social media to try and get help with picking. To their surprise, marketing manager Fleur Dawkins says they were inundated with offers.
It was incredible. We had hundreds of people respond on Facebook. We just kept getting messages of people wanting to come and help. It was a wonderful response from our community. We were in a really tough situation. We had to get the crop off really quickly, and we couldn't find backpackers who usually pick our crop. The backpackers weren't available from Mafra. So in the end, we did get the crop off in half the time that we usually do, which was fantastic.
The ongoing drought has forced wineries in East Gippsland to crush earlier. That's if they have irrigation. Those without won't harvest a drop. Glenmaggie Wines winemaker Tony Dawkins.
Most of us got most of our fruit off well before the smoke, which is great. When the fires were here, there was some small amount of smoke, which obliged us at least to pick our Shiraz and Cabernet a little bit earlier than we might have. The prospect of having a smoke sitting on it for that amount of time was too big a risk to take, so we picked it early. It forced me to make a slightly different wine. I've used some other techniques to extract flute flavour and other things that will bring that wine on. So I'm very happy that it's a very happy little wine in the tank at the moment, and I can taste no smoke taint in it whatsoever. Look, this year the drought's been very tricky for most of the East Gippsland wineries. Generally speaking, those with water have got through and got through okay. But anyone with a dry vineyard essentially got no fruit at all.
It wasn't just water that was an issue. Birds and, for the first time, bats played havoc in vineyards.
Bird pressure this year was unbelievable. We've had more birds than I've ever seen before. Lorikeets that we've never had before. And just numbers of birds. It was a big job just keeping them out of the nets, getting the nets on early enough.
But there is a positive. Mr. Dawkins says drought years often mean more intense wine.
On the bright side, when you have a drought, you usually get very intense fruit, and that's exactly what we got this year. So bunch size and berry size is small, but the flavours are fantastic. And so far, I think they're translating into the wines, which is lovely. We're delighted with our vintage, really. It was tricky towards the end, but we got through.
That's Glenmaggie Wines winemaker Tony Dawkins. And for today, that's Countrywide. But just a reminder, you can find details of all of our stories up on our website, abc.net.au/rural. My name's Isabella Pittaway. Until next time, catch you later.